what we don't do is really continue the testing that we can give each other in Chicago. All right, but thank you very much.
Thank you.
Please ask if you want to. The regular tea. Is that possible? So tell me if you don't mind.
Thank you.
Please turn off your cell phone. Thank you again.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. I hope you had a wonderful Yom Tov. And as I already told you, this is our last, at least my last year for a few weeks. So I'm sure there will be a wonderful substitute. We were looking, if you remember, the last thing we were looking at in the book of Mishlei was the very famous passage in Perek Vav about going to the ant, learning ant, meaning A-N-T, not the way New Yorkers pronounce your mother's brother, whatever, your mother's sister, whatever it is. Proper New Englanders say aunt. So when I say aunt, I mean namala. And the pasuk says, go to the ant, lazy person, and learn from the ant how to be industrious, how to look at the future. That is a midah of chachma, and the Vilna Gaon points out, thank you, is also an inyan, at least externally, of midos tovos. Not that the ant consciously decides to do good, but its behavior is considerate of others. He brings a medrash that says that an ant will not take a kernel of grain that was already taken by another ant colony. So they don't mind stealing from us, but they will not steal from another ant. That is an inyan of midos tovos and the like. So here, I want to skip ahead. I want to just show you a parallel passage in a very different part of the Sefer that also deals with the mila of industriousness and what that might mean on a deeper level. If you look all the way to the end of Perek Chafzayin, chapter 27, Pasuk Chaf Gimel 27:23. Because often what you find in the book of Mishlei is that Shlomo HaMelech will revisit a topic many, many times, several times in the book. And here too he revisits on a superficial level the chisaron of laziness and the need to be industrious. And he says the following, Pasuk Chaf Gimel, Perek Chaf Zayin, Pasuk Chaf Gimel, Yadoa teida pnei tzonecha, you shall know, meaning pay attention to the face of your sheep, meaning take care of your assets, take care of your sheep. Shislipcha liadorim, put your heart, again, be attentive to the flock. Again, we'll have to explain what is the difference between pnei tzonecha and adorim. Ki lo liolam chosen. Chosein, wealth, stored up wealth does not last forever. A person thinks he has a lot of property, I can let it go here and there. Wealth does not last forever. I'm sure you've heard over the years the famous joke about how to be a millionaire in Israel, how to make a million Israel come with 2 million. It's true, money goes, and one has to be careful. The imnezer l'dor v'dor, and royalty and kavod and honor, all the support systems a person might have, does not always last. And therefore one needs to be prudent. And the pasuk goes on again, we'll discuss a deeper meaning to this, but once again, ein mikra yotze midei pshuto, and indeed there are points about conserving wealth, and I'll talk about that, even from a ruchnius standpoint. Galach chatsir v'nir adesha, when the grass gets uncovered, and the vegetation is exposed, v'nesvu isvos harim, and there are grasses on the mountains. Again, the point that Shlomo HaMelech is making from an economic standpoint is that sheep and goats are a very good investment. And the reason why sheep and goats are a very good investment is you don't have to spend any money feeding them because they can eat the wild grasses. And they in turn give you wool for your clothing. And they give you, the goats at least, give you milk. You also get meat, but meat would be destroying the asset. But in terms of the renewability of the asset, it mentions that, number one, you feed them through the grass. Number two, kvasim lil vushecha, The wool of the sheep can be for your malbush, for your garments. Mechir sada atudim, you can take the rams and sell them and buy real estate, buy a field with the proceeds. V'dei chalei izim l'lachmecha, and there will be milk of goats for your food, for your bread, l'lechem beisecha, to feed your family. V'chayim, and this will give life l'narosecha. It will give, again, if you pshuto, it means that, what do they say, isn't there an expression in English like a milk-faced youth or something like that? In other words, the young women will look very beautiful by having this type of chalav and the like. Now, let me just say that although, obviously, life is not about making money, there is a certain spiritual dimension in taking care of your physical property. The Gemara in Chulin has a very remarkable statement. Tzadikim, chavivin lahem mamonam yosir migufam. Tzadikim care more about their money, more about their property, even more than their body. And the proof that the Gemara brings for this very strange statement is right, that before Yaakov Avinu meets Esav, he already took his family to a safe place, but he went back to where he was in the middle of the night. That is where he encountered the angel of Esav. And the Chumash does not give us any reason why he went back. But Chazal say that there were pachim ketanim. There were small jars that he left behind that he needed to retrieve. He wasn't going to let those jars stay by. Now, there are some sources in Kabbalah that say that that was a pach shemen, that in fact was the pach shemen of the Hanukkah miracle many, many hundreds of years later. But Lefi Pshuto, the Gemara in Chulin simply says that the tzaddik loves his mammon. Now one would think, that's a very strange thing. Tzaddik loves his mammon, the tzaddik doesn't care about physical things. But the answer is, a tzaddik realizes that every single thing Hashem put in his life is there for a purpose. Now that doesn't mean for his own selfish use, it might be for tztaka, it might be for gemilas chesed, it might be for hachnasas orchem. The concept is not, he keeps it for himself. But he keeps it for a purpose. If the tzaddik has 10 paper clips, there is a reason why he has 10. And therefore, if one is left behind, he goes back. Because it has a tachlis, it has a purpose. Again, I don't mean his selfish use, but whatever the purpose is. When you live for physical pleasure, then of course there'll be a certain element of superfluousness in what you have. You know, there are people who like own 30 cars. Now, you're literally people, they own 30 cars. Now, so Nebuchadnezzar, if you only had 29 cars, would your life be different in any way? So you could say, okay, I left the car behind. You know, I read an article recently, well, it was an old article, but I came across it, about a finishing school in Denver that teaches people how to be butlers or house managers for multimillionaires. Now, if you think that's a lowly job, it's quite a good job. If you could be the head of managing an estate, you can make $200,000 a year. So there are people who are lawyers who left law to kind of become house managers and butlers. So they were talking about some of the problems of being a butler or a house manager, an estate manager for the very wealthy. And that is, they have many houses, and they sometimes forget that they have a house. Like the guy might forget, oh yeah, I do own a house in Florida or in Texas. They just forget they have the house itself. So when it comes to a person who lives for hedonism, yeah, you can let things go a little bit. But a tzaddik understands that everything has a purpose. That is why when Yaakov describes his gashmias, Yaakov uses the word when he talks to Esav, Yeshli Kol, I have everything I need. When Esav describes his Gashmias, he says, Yeshli Rav, I have more than I need. Now, we might have thought we would reverse it. We might have thought the tzaddik says, I have more than I need. But that's not emes. The tzaddik will say, I have more than I need for my physical gratification. Yes. But he's not going to say, I have more than I need, because if Hashem gave it to me, there is a reason. And that goes the other way as well. If he has very little, he'll still say, I have all that I need. It goes both in the lower level and on the higher level. So that is the yesod of Baal Tashchis. That is why there's a lav in the Torah to waste things. Because what Hashem gives us has a tachlis, has a purpose, and we have to find a way to use it in a way that serves HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This is why we even find, if you remember, it's very interesting, at the beginning of the book of Malachim Aleph, when David HaMelech is on his deathbed, and David HaMelech is cold, he's shivering, and he cannot get warm. So what do Chazal say? Chazal say that this was a punishment to David, because he was mevazeh begadim, that when Shaul was pursuing him, and at one point Shaul was Mesech Esraglev, he was in the cave in the Beis HaKisei, and David cut off a piece of Shaul's garments, and he then showed Shaul, you see, I could have killed you, you were all alone in there, and I didn't. So Chazal don't say he was punished because he was mevazeh Shaul, but he was mevazeh begadim. He treated begadim with disrespect. And the Gemara says, anyone that treats begadim with disrespect, the begadim will have their revenge. And at the end, you will not get warm from them. Even though they're different garments, they're not the same garments and the like. By the way, an interesting point, just as to digress for a moment, you know, there's a Gemara in the Nedarim that says that one of the reasons for the Chorban Beis HaMikdash was the sin, this is the first Beis HaMikdash, that they didn't recite brachos over the Torah. And this is Gemara Nedarim. And the question is a big question. Why do we identify a relatively minor sin as not reciting brachos over the Torah? Now this is the first Beis HaMikdash. The first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of the biggest averos. Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, Shvichas Damim. And yet, the Gemara describes the Nevi'im not knowing. Alma Avdah Haaretz. We don't understand. Why was Eretz Yisrael destroyed? Why was the Beis HaMikdash destroyed? And they have to answer, because they didn't make Birchas HaTorah. The Nevi'im don't know why there was a Churban Beis HaMikdash. What do the Nevi'im talk about all the time? They constantly say, because of these Averos, Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, Shvichas Damim, there's going to be a Churban. Avodah Zarah is idolatry, Gilui Arayos is sexual immorality, and Shvichas Damim is murder. Those are the three big Averos for which a Jew must give his life. You'll see in a moment, how am I connecting this to clothing? You'll see in a second. So Rav Elia Lapian gave the following explanation. If it's true that even if you treat clothing with disrespect, the clothing is not going to help you, kal v'chomer, how much more so if you treat the Torah with disrespect, the Torah is not going to purify you, it's not going to elevate you. Now he says the following. When the Nevi'im asked, why was the Beis HaMikdash destroyed? They were not asking what were the sins that caused the Churban. They knew the sins that caused the Churban. It was Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, Shvichas Damim. But they were asking a deeper question. Given the fact that the Jewish people were learning the Torah, why didn't the Torah elevate them? Why didn't the Torah purify them? Why didn't the Torah make them better people? It's like a person who learns in yeshiva from 9 to 1, and then during lunch break goes out and murders and rapes, and comes back in time for mincha. There's something wrong with that picture, besides the horrendousness of the sin. But how could a person spend his hours learning and it doesn't affect him at all? That's the question. Meaning, when the Nevi'im ask, Alma Avdah Haaretz, they're not asking what was the sin that caused the Churban. We know what those sins were. But how could the Torah not protect them? And when the Gemara answers, they didn't recite the brachos over the Torah. That means they weren't grateful for the Torah. Meaning, they treated the Torah with disdain. And therefore, the Torah didn't protect them. And therefore, even though they learned Torah, Right? So you understand, it's not that, this is a deep thought, Ravel, you say, it's not that the sin of not reciting Birchas HaTorah caused the Chorban. As a sin, that would not have been enough to cause the Chorban. But their attitude towards the Torah meant that the same way you treat a sweater with disrespect, it's not going to keep you warm. You treat the Torah with disrespect, it's not going to elevate you. And then you are capable of learning 9 to 1 and then going out and raping and murdering in the afternoon. Because you're mevaza es haTorah. Now this is an important mussar for us, because it does mean that even if a person keeps mitzvot, a person learns Torah. But if they do so as a burden, as an imposition, they don't do so with joy, and they don't do so with gratitude to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then chas v'shalom, the Torah does not elevate us. It does not change us. We can be the same people before and after. Because if one is mevaza the beged, it does not give him chamimus. Right? You treat the beged with disrespect, it does not give you warmth. You treat Hashem's Torah with disrespect, it does not give you elevation. That was just a little digression. Rav Elia uses this Gemara of Mevaza es HaBegadim to explain the Gemara. They didn't say the brachos over the Torah. Okay. But be it as it may, therefore, for the tzaddik, there is nothing at all that is superfluous. Everything has a purpose. And therefore you're concerned about everything. You don't want things to go to waste. Now again, one shouldn't be a meshugana about it, you know, as it were. I'm not necessarily talking about recycling everything, recycling paper plates, you know, whatever it is. One is allowed to live. Although I will tell you something that was very, very upsetting. That sometimes, you know, Yerushalayim, as all of us know, unfortunately, has a litter problem. I'm not sure exactly why, but for some reason the concept of throwing stuff in the streets has not permeated societal consciousness as something that you're not supposed to do. Yeah.
Why did Tzadikim?
Which one? I didn't hear you. This is Gemara in Chulin. Gemara in Chulin.
Yeah.
Oh, why your Tzadikim?
Gufam?
You know, I understand. It's the Mefarshim already say that already is a little bit of a guzma. Your Tzadikim Gufam just means that it was kedai to put himself in a certain element of sakana in order to get the pachim ketanim. So he was putting his body at risk. At risk. Doesn't mean his guf is less important than his mamon. Avada, his guf is more important, but it means he's willing to be misaken himself, because again, he was batuach, that this was a shalichus mitzvah, and would be einam nizakim. Yeah. Yeah.
David HaMelech couldn't be worn by the clothing, because he abused the clothing with children.
That's correct, yeah.
So, how come he was worn by Avisha Kashunami after
being with Bathsheba? Yeah, well, that is a good question. But I would have to say this. I would have to say that although his chait with Bathsheba was a tremendous chait, but we would not describe it as being mevaza her. In other words, if anything, his relationship with Bathsheba was one of great kavod. Now, yes, there was a chait involved, but you don't find him disparaging her. In other words, the analogy you're drawing would be if somebody raped a woman, God forbid, or somebody treated a woman with abuse, then he would not get warmth from that. But that wasn't David's chait in that sense. Okay. Now, the point I want to make is that even the prosaic meanings here about, you know, being careful with your money are not trivial, that they do have spiritual dimensions that one needs to be aware of. But again, as we always know, the Gra tries to give us deeper meanings under the surface, and as well as address repetitions of different phrases. So here the Gra says that sonecha, sheep, refers to the students that you teach Torah to, meaning to say, like we talk about, either a Rebbe or a Mora, or a parent for that matter, is like the shepherd of a flock. By the way, a beautiful thing, everyone knows, of course, the 23rd Tehillim, Mizmor Chaf Gimel, right, one of the most famous of the Tehillim, Mizmor LeDavid, Hashem Roi Lo Echsar. It's even famous among the Goyim. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, I shall not lack anything. So it's very, very interesting that there's a little book. I'd like to get it. I don't have this book myself, but I really would like to get it. It was written by an Arab Christian around 50 years ago who happened to be a shepherd. He happened to be a shepherd. And he said, you know, people don't understand. You know, you live in urban societies. You really don't know what it's like to be a shepherd. But if you really understand what a shepherd does, and of course Chazal talk about Moshe Rabbeinu, the Avos being shepherds, then you'll understand so much more in a deep way what it means to say Hashem is our shepherd. And it's a very beautiful idea that he actually goes through what he does as a shepherd, and then he tries to apply it to Hashem. And he makes an interesting point. One point that he makes is, he says that sheep have very poor vision. Sheep don't see very clearly. And that's why they're very skittish, they're very afraid. And they also know, because sheep have this thick wool, that if a sheep falls over, the sheep will not be able to pull itself up. It's too heavy. I don't know how sheep do this in the wild. I'm not sure that, you know, how they, because there are wild sheep as well. But whatever it is, the domestic sheep that is raised for long-haired wool literally cannot stand up if it falls, and if it goes through water, it's also stuck because it gets so waterlogged that it would drown. So as a result, the shepherd has to be very sensitive. I mean, Chazal already tell us about Moshe Rabbeinu carrying the lambs to the water, etc. But the concept too is that as human beings, we're often frightened, we're often confused, we often don't know how to support ourselves when we fall down. And Hashem is that shepherd that comes and lifts us up and carries us and shows us where we need to go, even though we can't. This, again, is a very beautiful idea that, you know, the culture of the Nevi'im and Ksuvim, of the Torah itself, is a very different material culture than we face today. So we often don't really understand metaphors that well. We don't understand the metaphors because it's not part of our life. We don't know what a shepherd is. When Esh Haschayel talks about the woman runs the spinning wheel, unless you know, maybe some of you know, unless you know what a spinning wheel is, you don't really appreciate it. So the truth is, it's kedai to spend some time to understand physically the different things that existed during biblical times, to go to a museum or something, because then you understand what the psukim are saying in a much better way. So the Gra says, just as Hashem is our shepherd, so too a teacher, a Rebbe, a Mora, is a shepherd to a flock as well. And it's making the point that there are two types of relationships that you have with your students, generally. One is called Sonecha, your sheep, and the other is called Adorim, the flock. Now this may not apply to every person, this may applies really. The truth of the matter is, let me give you a biographical digression here, because I think in many, many ways, the Gra's comment should be understood by reference to the Gra's own life. The Vilna Gaon, as you know, did not have any official position, even in the city of Vilna. He was not the Rav of Vilna. In fact, he sometimes got in trouble because sometimes he violated community minhagim and he had to get special permission, etc. He was not the head of a beis din. He was not the head of a yeshiva. The Vilna Gaon was a private citizen. A private citizen. And most of the time he never left his house. Most of the time he just stayed at home. A few times he, you know, wandered around to, and he was arrested, etc. But there's some incidents in the Vilna Gaon's life. But by and large, the number of Talmidim that he ever had learning with him was a relatively small number of people. Maybe 10 people, maybe 20 people, sometimes 2 people. He did not have a big yeshiva. He did not have many Talmidim. Now we do know that one of his Talmidim, Rav Chaim of Volozhin, did indeed start the great Volozhiner Yeshiva, which was the mother, it's called the Eim HaYeshivas, it was the mother of all the other great yeshivas in Europe, whether it's Mir, or Telz, or Panovich, or Baranovich, and those yeshivas in turn became the foundation of the yeshivot in Eretz Yisrael, and in America, and in Gateshead, and in Europe, etc. So in many, many ways, the Vilna Gaon may have concentrated his efforts on only a select few. But those select few became the foundation of Torah to thousands and tens of thousands of people until this very day. He concentrated his efforts, you might say, to the elite. I mean, after all, I mean, the average person might not have gained a lot from learning from the Vilna Gaon. We wouldn't have understood him. So he put his kochos into the special, unique gedolim, with the understanding that they, in turn, would have a ripple effect on tens of thousands. You know, they say after World War II, after the Holocaust, there was a great Rosh Yeshiva who came from Europe, Rav Shlomo Hyman, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of Torah Vadas. And he was Rav Baruch Ber's, Leibovich's Talmid Muvak. And Rav Shlomo Hyman, after the war in 1946, 1947, was giving a shiur to five people. And he had been giving a shiur in Europe to hundreds of people. And he was giving a shiur to five people, and he was excited, and he was gesticulating, and he was gesturing, and he was yelling. And somebody asked him after, you sound like you're giving a shiur to 500 people. There were only five people in the room. He said, I am giving a shiur to 500 people, because I'm not just giving a shiur to these five people, I'm giving a shiur to their children and to their grandchildren and to their students, because what I give them is going to be passed on. And therefore I am not just doing this little thing now, but what I'm doing is something that's going to impact on Dorei Doros. So the Vilna Gaon says, going back to the pasuk, Sonecha are the individual people that you teach. And they may be small in number. The Adarim, which means the flocks, are the hordes of future generations that are going to be influenced, whether they're your own grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and those who will be born long after we die. But the good influences are still there, and unfortunately the bad influences can also be there too. In fact, that's what Chaim Voloshin writes. That is actually why, on a yahrzeit, a person is rejudged every year. And people ask the kasha, well, a person dies, so whatever his mitzvos and averos are, that's what it is. What's the purpose of rejudging a person? 1,000 years after he died, the person gets judged every yahrzeit? The answer is because HaKadosh Baruch Hu looks at all the ripple effects. And those ripple effects change and grow with the passage of time. You know, if you were makarev one person to Torah, and as a result of that action, that person's children, grandchildren, etc., are faithful to Hashem, then you get schar for all of those mitzvos and masim tovim. And the other way around, if chas v'shalom, one created a chilul Hashem, and that drove a person away, a person is accountable. You know, they tell an actual story about a fellow. There was a fellow in Dallas. It's a story. I don't remember all the details, but it's in either a Pesach Kron or Chanuch Teller. One of the gifted storytellers recount this story about a fellow in Dallas who really wasn't religious. But like the last 6 months of his life, he started going to the Dallas Kollel. And then he made a will, and he died young. He had a heart attack. He died relatively young. But he left like $5 million to the Kollel. Nobody expected. He wasn't that religious, and you know, he wasn't even that involved with the Kollel. And nobody understood, like, why? What? So it turned out that he had told somebody before he went into the hospital that he was visiting Yerushalayim, and he was at the Kotel, and he saw a Hasidish guy davening mincha. And he was so moved by the kavana that the person had that he said he wants to support Torah that produces people who can daven with such hislavos and such kavana. Now, he didn't go over to the Hasidish guy. The Hasidish guy, you know, never met him. The Hasidic guy doesn't know that $5 million was given to a kollel because of him. So imagine, this is what the story says. So imagine after 120 years, the Hasidic guy goes to Shemayim. And they're going over the mitzvos and the averos and the maisim tovim. So to his good fortune, somebody, you know, one of the malachim say, oh, don't forget, because of him, $5 million was given to a kollel. Look at all the hachzakas Torah. Well, I'm sure the guy is going to be pleased. What is that? I have no idea what you're talking about. But yeah, this is the answer. The answer is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu credits us not only with the things that we consciously do, but with the things that we've done that we didn't even know that we did. And sometimes, the things that we don't know or remember that we did turn out to be the most important things. I'm sure you've had this experience. Sometimes, I've had it many times. You know, a person has many conversations in the course of a life. And you know, you think, well, this conversation was important, this was significant, this really meant something. And then there's very casual encounters that don't seem to be very important. And somebody might tell you later that little unimportant conversation changed their life. And the big important thing didn't have any ruchim at all, didn't do anything at all. So we're not necessarily the judges. You know, life is kind of like a multiple choice test. What do they say? You never really know what the right answer is. You know, you pick the answer, you know, you're not really sure. This is a frustration in these types of choices. We're not always the best judges as to what is important in our life and what is not important. But this is the idea of the Adarim, that when one learns Torah, when one teaches Torah, when one does mitzvahs, when one conveys attitudes, on one hand, you're looking at the people, your children, your students that you're working with right now, but you also think about the Adarim that will be in the future. In fact, I want to point out that the Vilna Gaon himself was concerned not only with future generations, but even with the simple working Balabatim in Vilna itself. Now, obviously, he wasn't going to spend his time teaching people Aleph Beis, but not because it wasn't worthwhile, it is worthwhile, but there are other people to do it. So, you know, a gadol will not do things that other people can do just as well. But the Vilna Gaon was very concerned that even the working people who were not learning that much should have regular shiurim. So he organized shiurim in Ein Yaakov. Ein Yaakov is the Agada of the Gemara, typically between Mincha and Maariv. In fact, there's even a phrase in Yiddish, it's kind of an affectionate phrase. Sometimes it's used pejoratively, but it's largely affectionate, about a conscientious, simple Jew who is not a big Talmud Chacham, but serves Hashem with sincerity. He is called an Ein Yaakov Yid, because he would go to the Ein Yaakov Shir between Mincha and Maariv. He organized shiurim in Chaye Yadam. Chaye Yadam was actually written by the Vilna Gaon's own Mechutin, Rav Avram Danzig. But the Chaye Yadam is the sefer that people use today. It's like a Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. But Kitzur Shulchan Aruch was more popular in Hungary. In Lithuania, the Chaye Yadam was the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. And the like, and he organized those shiurim. And in fact, in order to encourage people to go, he gave the first shiur. So fascinating. So he gave, in other words, if an Ein Yaakov shiur was started, the Vilna Gaon gave the first shiur, which is pretty amazing. You're a shoemaker, you come in for a mincha, you're tired, you're going to sit down for a half an hour Ein Yaakov shiur. And the Vilna Gaon is teaching. Now keep in mind, just to see the Vilna Gaon was a big deal. Because you have to understand, the Vilna Gaon was not seen that much. I mean, he was in his home, and just to look at him, they describe it as an awesome, fearsome, like the light of the Shekhinah shining from his face. So for him to show up at a regular mincha and give an Ein Yaakov shiur to working people was a very, very special event. But this is the example of Adarim, of caring about the whole community and not just the particular Talmidim. So as a result, the person has to balance his efforts with the elites together with a concern for Klal Yisrael as a whole. Now this, of course, gives rise to all sorts of excruciatingly difficult problems in creating yeshivos. You know, it's been pointed out already, this is a complicated issue, that yeshivos are largely geared for elitist learning, if you know what I mean. Yeah, in other words, a yeshiva curriculum, I'm talking about yeshiva gedola. But the truth is, it seeps down even to yeshiva katana. A yeshiva gedola is geared for people who have very, very strong analytical intelligence, people who have fast minds, etc. And as a result, many people, many boys, who are very, very fine and even intelligent, but this is not where they would excel. They're kind of condemned to being mediocre, and people have said that there's a whole other Torah curriculum that would be better, more chumash, more halacha, less of the theoretical lumdus. But the counter-argument is, but the only way you're going to get the real gedolim is by giving them this advanced learning. So the shekel is it better to create a system that produces the gadol, even if the non-gadolim suffer? Or to create a system in which more people benefit, but you produce less gadolim? Now, there is a famous or infamous quote from Rav Dessler, where Rav Dessler said, you know, there's a statement in Chazal, 1,000 students go in to learn Chumash, and only one comes out able to paskin. So most of us just understand that just means that only one will be the Posek Hador. But Rav Dessler says this is actually a military analogy. It's worthwhile to have 999 casualties in order to produce the Gadol, meaning to say you create the system that produces the Gadol. Now some people are abhorred by that statement. It is a big, big controversy. And I don't want to address this issue because either way, none of us are in a position to do anything about this. But this is a very, very live issue in Torah Chinuch. And that is, do you create alternative yeshiva structures? Or do you kind of keep with the time-honored standard of excellence, even if that does not well serve many, many boys? So it is an issue that one needs to consider. And of course, as parents and grandparents, we have to consider this for our own child as well, you know, what is best. Again, the Chazon Ish expressed in Hashkafa that you never know who will be the gadol. In other words, if you start sorting people off and say, well, you're medium, so you're going to go to a yeshiva that only does halacha and chumash, perhaps you're giving up the potential gadol. On the other hand, if you say everybody goes to these high-rated yeshivas, then there's going to be quite a few people who, you know, will be failures. Right, so it's a very, very difficult shikul. It really is one of the most difficult problems that we have in the chinuch system. For girls, it's less of a problem, although it's become a problem as well, but theoretically it should be less of a problem, because since women do not have the chiyuv of Talmud Torah, so it's theoretically less important for a seminary to push detailed textual study. But as you know, many seminaries, bedafka, do move in that direction. Other seminaries emphasize more Midot Tovot, Yirat Shemayim, etc. They're less textual. So at least in the girls' part, you do have options. There are options in the girls' chinuch that you don't fully have in the boys' chinuch. The boys' chinuch tends to be more single-directed. So in a way, girls, the very fact that there is no chiyuv of Talmud Torah has freed them from a certain rigidity in the system. Okay, but this is a Again, this is an important issue to discuss. But be it as it may, that is how the Gra understands Pnei Tzonecha. And he then discusses a digression. Now this digression, it's very difficult to see how it's connected to the Pasuk. But the digression might be the single most famous thought in the entire book of Mishlei from the Gra. I'm sure you've heard it before. And it really starts off as a peripheral digression on the word chosen and the word nezer. Chosen,
where are you?
Yeah, this is verse Chaftalah, 24. Chosen is wealth. Nezer is crown, is a crown. And the Gra brings from the Zohar that there are two types of wealth in a spiritual sense, and there are two types of crowns in a spiritual sense. The two types of wealth in a spiritual sense is called bayis v'hom. He has another pasuk that says bayis v'hom nachalat avot. Bayit is a home, a house. Hon is wealth. And he says allegorically, the bayis is yiras shamayim, and the wealth is Torah learning. And the fact that without a house, the wealth will not be preserved or protected reminds us that without Yiras Shamayim, your Torah learning is not going to remain. That's why we always say, Yiras Hashem Hi Otsaro. also a pasuk in Mishlei. Fear of God is the otsar. Otsar is the treasure house. All of your Torah is not going to stay with you unless you have the treasure house of Yiras Shamayim. So bias v'hon is the true chosen, the true wealth, and that is the internal Torah that you learn that is protected by the Yiras Shamayim. Now, with respect to the Malchus, or Nezer, Nezer is the crown of glory, here he says there are two types of Malchus that exist in the world. Now again, I have to apologize because he doesn't really connect it to the context of the Psukim. Very, very difficult. It's not. I must have read this over 10 times, and I don't see a connection. But the word itself is very important. He says, there is what is called a Melech, and there is what is called a Moshel. You find by Yosef, when Yosef had his dream of his sheaves standing up and the other sheaves bowing down, or the Kochavim bowing down to him. So what did the brothers say? Hamaloch timloch aleinu. Shall you be our Melech? Hamashol timshol banu. Shall you be our Moshel? What's the difference? Or another pasuk. Ki lashem hamlucha u'moshel bagoyim. Moshel means ruler. Melech and... That's the pasuk in Zechariah. Ki lashem hamlucha u'moshel bagoyim. So what is the difference between Melech and Moshel? So the Gra says, and this is a very, very famous chiluk. Melech is someone who has been voluntarily accepted as a king. When we make someone a king because we want him to be our king, that is called a melech. A moshel is someone who forces his rule upon you. Now, maybe he's a dictator, he's a bad guy. He may be a righteous person as well because he needs to, you know, rule over us. So, when the pasuk says in Zechariah, Ki lashem hamlucha, that means the following. Mulucha is the same as melech. With respect to the Jewish people, we proclaim Hashem as melech. We accept Hashem as melech. We said at Matan Torah, Naseh v'nishma, we accept. Legabe the umos ha'olam who don't accept Hashem. Hashem is a moshel. He's still the moshel. But he's not a melech. That's why Rosh Hashanah is about the idea of being mamlech. What does it mean to make Hashem a melech? Right? That would be a very strange phrase without the Vilna Gaon. What do you mean, I make Hashem a melech? Hashem is a melech. No, he's not. Hashem is Moshel until I accept him. When I accept him, I make him a melech. And that's what the pasuk says in Zechariah again. V'haya Hashem Lamelech al kala aretz. When Mashiach comes, Hashem will become Melech al kol haaretz. Is not Hashem the Melech now? No, he's not. Hashem is the Moshel now, except for those who accept Hashem. But when the whole world accepts HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then he becomes a Melech. And now, this is Hashem's Ratzon. Now, why does Hashem care about it so much is a difficult question. But Hashem wants us to be Mamlech Hashem, to accept Him as a king with love. And that is what the brothers are saying to Yosef. Yosef has dreams that he's going to rule over them. So they're saying to Yosef, sarcastically, you're not going to get anything out of us. Hamaloch timloch aleinu? Do you think we're going to accept you as our king? You got another thing going. We're certainly not going to accept you as a melech. And if you think you're so powerful, you're going to make yourself a Moshel, that's not going to work either. Right? So, Hamaloch timloch aleinu? You're not going to be our melech? And you're only a kid, you're not going to be a Moshel either. And of course, the truth of the matter is, they were wrong on both accounts. Because before Yosef revealed himself, he was very much a Moshe'el. He was calling the shots, he was giving the orders, and they had to obey him whether they liked it or not. Afterwards, they accepted him as their spiritual leader because of his righteousness, because of the fact that he didn't bear a grudge. So he became both their Moshe'el and their Melech. But initially they said, you're not our Melech, and you're not our Moshe'el. Right, so that's the Vilna Gaon says. Now again, I don't know what the shaychus to the pasuk here is, other than he focuses on the idea of Nezer. Based on the Zohar, there are called Trei Itrin, that's Aramaic, there are two crowns. One is the crown of Melech, one is the crown of Moshe'el, and the greatness of Am Yisrael is that we are Mamlech HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now the same idea comes out in Adon Olam. In the Zemer Adon Olam, which is in the Siddur every day, some people do say it every day, a lot of places they sing it Friday night or Shabbos day, and the minhag of the Gra is people don't do it at all except on maybe Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. But be it as it may, the author of Adon Olam was a very, very great Tzaddik poet, Rav Shlomo Ibn Gaboral, who lived a little before the Ibn Ezra, so it goes back a long time ago, the 11th century, the 1000s. And Rav Shlomo Gaboral says the following, Adon Olam, you were the master of the universe, Beterem Kol Yitzir Nivra, before anything was created, but Lies Nasa Bechetzo Kol, but only after you completed your creation, Azai Melech Shemo Nikra, only then did you become a Melech. Because until you had human beings who are capable of... See, an angel cannot proclaim Hashem as a Melech. Because angels don't have Bechira. So Hashem is their ruler. Only the person who could reject Hashem can make Hashem a Melech. Because making Hashem a Melech is choosing to make Hashem a Melech. So paradoxically, it is the very fact that we can rebel. This is the old story. Who is higher, an angel or a human being? Angels are much higher. They don't sin. They're holy. We are lowly because we sin. But it's our very lowliness that gives us something that even the highest angel cannot have. And that is in our ability to rebel against Hashem. When we choose to serve Hashem, we are making Hashem a Melech. And that's only a Baal Bechira is able to do. Yeah. That's correct. That's correct. That's exactly right. In fact, the whole Nusach of the Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur Davening emphasizes Melech over and over and over again. Melech al kol ha'aretz, Malchios. And indeed, in Chassidus, Rosh Hashanah is called the Yom Hamlacha or the Yom Hachtara, meaning the day of coronation, because that's the notion of coronation. So again, as I say, this is a very, very famous thought of the Gra that is very, very useful for us, for Rosh Hashanah, especially, but really the whole year, as it were. But as I say, the shachas to the pasuk is a little unknown. But be it as it may, I wish you well, and we should all have a... wonderful Sfiras HaOmer. Just end with a little thought. So I'm coming back. Be'ezras Hashem, I wish it wouldn't be so long, but I will be back beginning of June. So the month of May is gone. But I just want to mention one beautiful thought from the Baal HaTanya. The Baal HaTanya expresses a very, very beautiful difference between Pesach and Shavuos. And he says, Pesach, Hashem lifts us to a madrega that we really didn't earn. As for example, by Kriyas Yamsuf, even the maidservants saw the Shekhinah equal to the greatest of the Nevi'im. So Pesach HaKadosh Baruch Hu lifts us to a great, great height. But it's artificial. He then puts us back on the ground and step by laborious step, we have to earn what it is that He showed us. So Pesach is the gift from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Sviras HaOmer is taking what Hashem showed us we could become and enables us to now become it by our own efforts. And he says that's Merumas in the Pasuk of Shir HaShirim, where the Jewish people, who are portrayed as the woman that is beloved, says to her lover, Mashcheini acharecha, pull me after you, narutza, so we can run. Pull me after is Pesach, where essentially we are the recipients of divine grace. Narutza, we run together, is the reciprocity of Shavuos, where through the process of Sfiras HaOmer, we internalize within ourselves the gifts that Hashem gave us. And Rav Nachman of Breslov brings from the Baal Shem Tov a beautiful mashal to a baby learning to walk. That is, when a baby initially learns to walk, the parents are holding the baby up by the arm, so the baby walks. At some point, the parents let go, and the baby plops down. And if the baby could verbalize its thoughts, the baby might think, why am I regressing? But in reality, it's a higher and deeper level, because the first was the artificial support. Now you have to make it your own. And that is the relationship, the Baal HaTanya says, between the holiday of Pesach, which is called kfitza, sudden jumps, and sfira, which is a gradual, slow, incremental process. So, Be'ezras Hashem, we should be zochet to work on that process, and we're going to be mekabel karach.